The most important part of a podcast are the people who listen to it. When I create a podcast for Musicians Map, I try to capture the best recording that I can, and I have strict rules in place for my guests to capture their audio correctly, so that we can present to you something that's comfortable to listen to. Ideally, while listening to this podcast, you won't even think about the sound quality because you'll be so focused on the conversation. But I guarantee you that if we neglected the sound quality, it's all you'd think about and all you'd hear, and probably not for very long. By putting effort into the audio quality of this audio production, I'm recognizing that the listener experience comes first, because without listeners, there's no podcast. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking about creating a podcast, or you already have one, I'd encourage you to seriously consider your audio setup, guest recording protocols, and your overall sound quality. And if those things are outside your realm of expertise, I'd encourage you to seek out professional help. This podcast is produced by Precision Podcasting, a company that takes sound quality seriously. We work with podcasters from getting the right gear and capturing quality recordings, right through to detailed editing and broadcast standard mastering. If you care about your podcast and care about your listeners, care about your audio quality, get in touch with me via the Precision Podcasting website, precisionpodcasting.com, or email me at kane@precisionpodcasting.com. All right, welcome back to the Musicians Map podcast. It's been a while and a lot has changed since the last episode. Before I play the conversation with Dan, I'd like to let you know about my new music project, Team Squad. As many musicians did, and as I discussed with Dan in this episode, Team Squad is a project that started in lockdown with my wife and I spending our spare time having fun creating music. But it's a little more than that, as this project really was the catalyst to get us both playing music regularly again, and actually doing it just for fun. It's kind of math-inspired alternative R&B soul, which sounds bizarre, but it makes sense if you like things a little bit different. It's full of riffs and good vibes, and we're really enjoying playing music again. Check out Team Squad at facebook.com/teamsquadband. teamsquad.bandcamp.com, and on Spotify, where you'll find our EP, Sass Bucket. You're actually already listening to it. Dan Stevenson is the guitarist for mathcore band Frontera and has a new project in a very different style coming out shortly called Lift. I've had a listen to Lift, and I seriously recommend that you do too. It's amazing, it's really interesting, and features some beautiful sounds, and as he mentions, it's got something for everyone. So after listening to this podcast and hearing everything Dan has to say about his new project, go and have a listen to Lift. You'll find links in the show notes. Dan, welcome to the Musicians Map podcast. Amazing to have you here.
Thanks so kindly, Kane. Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on. Super psyched to have a good long chat.
Yeah, man. So let's start at the start. Where you grew up, what your kind of earliest years were like, and your first musical memory.
Yeah, it's pretty colourful, to be honest. I've been super lucky in my life, and I've lived in a lot of places and travelled around extensively and quite a lot. So I was born in Scotland, and then before I was a year old, I moved out to South Africa, and I actually lived there until I was about 7 or 8. So yeah, my beginnings with music are very kind of rooted in African music. Yeah, I think that's why I'm so heavily into like rhythmic music in general. I went to a school there where there's lots of kind of like indigenous music and like lots of school groups for that kind of thing. Spent loads and loads of time outdoors. My dad was really, really into music as well, more popular and like commercial music than sort of like indigenous roots African music. So yeah, I guess that was kind of like the beginning of my path to music. But I kind of left there when I was like 7 or 8. So I wasn't really overly attached to music at that point. It was just a bit more of one of those things that's like fun because it's loud sort of feeling. But I always kind of knew I liked music at that age. And then we moved back to Scotland at that point, and that would have been in 95. Yeah, moving from South Africa to the northeast of Scotland is like, you can get more different places at all. So yeah, super, super different sort of experiences. And that was just like a work situation for my parents. And so yeah, then I guess I got used to like snow and the cold and stuff instead of like 30, 40, 50 degrees. And so yeah, anyway, went through school and primary school, and I kind of got really into to guitar music. And I've been lucky as well. I've got an older brother that's like about 10 or 11 years older than me. And so I was just gifted all of these incredible CDs when I was in like my final year of primary school, then going into secondary school. And it was really broad. It was like stuff from like the grunge origins, from like Nirvana, Alice in Chains, Soundgarden, Pixies, all that kind of stuff, to much more modern stuff as well. At that time, like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And he was really into like techno and rave, which was quite cool. That kind of got me a little bit of a glimpse into electronic music. And that kind of like sparked a bit of a fire in me. I kind of got like quite obsessive. That there'll be a bit of a theme that kind of comes up, that I'm generally quite an obsessive person. But I was really into Alice in Chains and Nirvana. I just couldn't stop like learning about Kurt Cobain and Seattle and the grunge scene. And I think that's where my kind of love for underground or subculture music actually came from, was that, because I just love this idea that there's this whole world going on underground with music and art in places that, you know, the mass public don't really know anything about. And so then I did what everyone did at that age and picked up a guitar and tried to learn Smells Like Teen Spirit, and it sounded like trash. And I had a couple of friends that played guitar as well, and they were so much better than me, and it really discouraged me. So I actually stopped playing for a year after the first like 3 months of being terrible. And so yeah, then I asked for guitar lessons, and luckily my parents kind of scraped together enough for like a lesson a week for a year. And they were kind of like, if you can't really get the basics in a year, and we kind of invest in lessons, then that's kind of fair game, then we've tried sort of thing. And I agreed. I was like, yeah, fair enough. Like, it's not cheap. We weren't like a rich family or anything, so that was quite a big deal to me. And the guitar teacher I had was just incredible. He used to tour with like Primal Scream, and he was like a proper like 70s rocker sort of dude.
Yeah.
And taught me loads of like Led Zeppelin and basics of scales and arpeggios and kind of how to use like music theory a little bit. And that kind of like connected the dots for me, because I was really just like tabs and by ear kind of thing before. Mm. And so that kind of like set me up to think that I could potentially study music in a kind of way. I guess at that point I was kind of forming my first band. I've always just done things DIY. Like, even in that first band, we like pressed our own t-shirts, made our own CDs. We used to go like flyer and do all the things that DIY bands do. But it was a kind of like soft rock. Yeah, it definitely wasn't like a heavy band at all. I had a really great female singer who's now like a professional operatic singer, which is quite interesting. But we did that for a while. And then I kind of got into heavier music. I found Trivium. They're one of the kind of first heavier bands that I liked. And then that kind of like opened up the door to like, you know, that early 2000s metalcore kind of thing, into new metal as well. I was really into like Slipknot and Linkin Park and all that kind of stuff. I guess I just never grew out of that really extreme, terrifying music. I just kept going further and further.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose after that, then I was like just doing high school bands like everyone. And I kind of, a lot of my friends at that time were thinking about studying something like quote unquote real, that would get them a real job and stuff. But I was just like not keen on that idea. I just wanted to like rock out and play guitar and shred.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go back a bit. What's your favorite Alice in Chains album?
So I did it the wrong way around. I got MTV Unplugged, and then I was like, oh man, this guy's voice is just so, so full of emotion. And I guess I went to like Jar of Flies after that. I guess that would be my kind of go-to after. What about yourself?
Jar of Flies, yeah.
Yeah.
100%. Can't go past it.
It's just the best.
It's too good. It's
totally
too good.
The best.
What about favorite Slipknot record?
So tough. Like, I feel like they've evolved so much, and as I've really become like a production nerd, I go back and find different things in their records now than I did the first time. I think as an all-rounder, there's just something with Iowa that just kind of grabs me. It's like, I remember feeling scared the first time I saw the videos on MTV and Scuzz was the channel we had over here. It's that excited feeling that is what led me to Frontiera in a long-winded story that we'll get to, but it's that same feeling of just general sonic fear. And I never understood it the first time round. I just didn't get it. I was just scared of it. And then I kind of went back to it a couple of years after. And the whole thing, I love art and music that creates its own world, because there can't be rules. There's no boundaries. And Slipknot were one of the first to do it with that sort of real, like, serious approach to aggressive music.
Yeah, it's really interesting you say that, actually, because I totally agree. Firstly, that's their best record, but it was like scary.
Yeah.
You know, like it had come out like, I don't know, you know, I'd been listening to Slayer and, you know, listen to kind of heavy and extreme bands. Slipknot put out their first record and I kind of ignored it, you know, because it seemed a bit cheesy. But then when Iowa came out, I remember listening to it and thinking it was a little bit terrifying.
Yeah.
just in the way that they played, and so relentless, and the way he screamed, and the noise and the art and the videos, as you say, all the package, it was pretty terrifying. And I think a lot of people really latched onto that, and it changed the perspective.
Yeah.
Because that was also a really big, big successful, not really mainstream, but mainstream metal album.
Yeah.
Kind of made them one of the biggest bands in the world. And to make something that extreme and get that reception and be so well known for it is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, big time. And I think it's also like the aesthetic and the consideration for like every component of that. It wasn't like you'd never see that band at 8 out of 10. And that's what it made me love that whole thing. It's just like, it's absolutely all or nothing. And I think I've kind of developed that approach with a lot of like my kind of musical and artistic sort of inclinations is just based on that. It's like, if you're going to give someone an experience, it needs to be all encompassing and a sensory experience. And I think they nailed that like 20 years ago, they nailed that.
Yeah, they really did. Okay, so you're at high school, you've been playing guitar for, what, a couple of years?
Yeah, like 4 years maybe, yeah.
What would you say was your first band that was maybe not a high school band?
The next kind of band that kind of got off the ground was everyone's phase of metalcore and screamo. And mine was a group called Forgive the Silent. And that was like the first band that did like decent support gigs and did pretty well like regionally. And funnily enough, what one of our last gigs was actually, there's quite a big Scottish metal band called Bleed From Within. So about 10 years ago, or longer, maybe 13 years ago, actually, they had come to the town that I'd grown up in and supported us on a headliner that we were on. And then years and years later, I actually nearly, I kind of started a band with their vocalist a little bit and kind of wrote a few songs. And I told them that story. It's so funny because now they're just huge. Like, they've toured with Megadeth and they've toured all over the world with like huge, huge bands. But so, yeah, we had this kind of like metalcore sort of, I guess it was like in the vein of Unearth or Killswitch, that sort of direction. Mm-hmm. And that was really cool. That kind of gave me a bit of hope that it's like, you know, you can kind of build a bit of a community around people loving something that's also quite obscure. And that went for a couple of years. And I feel like in every band that I've been in, I've always, my whole life has kind of just been like a series of finding ways to learn from some situations. And with that very first band, I learned that, you know, the foundations of like spending like 10 hours a day with people at a young age, I learned how to do that with that band. And then this next one that I was in, this metalcore one, kind of learned a lot more about the industry and how to kind of work in a bit more of a professional manner. And I was kind of getting my music degree at that same time. So I was kind of developing all these like industry skills, but also like the practical playing sort of skills and theoretical skills. And so that kind of petered out when I went off to university. So I went to uni after I'd finished a year at college, just to kind of give me a bit more of like a basis to go and study properly, because I still wasn't really like in my own mind that competent, but I just needed another year, I guess, after school. So yeah, I went to college, then I went to uni. And then the next thing that kind of got off the ground was a group called Out of Samsara. And that was another kind of little notch above. That was one that got touring quite a lot. And my first tour out into mainland Europe in Germany was that group as well. And that's when I was starting to be a bit more broad musically. So that was a lot more along the vein of Isis and Pelican, Russian Circles, much more towards the post-metal side of things. And I was experimenting a lot with guitar sounds and a lot of like odd time signatures and rhythms and stuff. And it was quite a popular thing at that time. It was around the time that like Explosions in the Sky and So I Watch You From Afar Dinosaur and Mogwai. It was like, that was really all the raids. That was about 2008 or 9 was around then that we did that. And that was so cool. That was like one of the first times where we had like gone to different parts of the country and people knew the band, and we were getting support shows with like really big bands at that time, like Ocean Size and This Will Destroy You and things like that.
Wow.
That was really, really cool. And, you know, being at uni and getting to go tour in Europe and to kind of see a bit of a kind of a thing happening around the project that I was in, it was a real good kind of confidence boost to be like, yeah, maybe this is like a good direction to go in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's awesome. So, okay, you're doing a music degree as well.
Yeah.
And now you said before, you know, a lot of your friends were like, oh, I'm, you know, this is all great. Playing music is cool, but I'm going to go and do something that's actually real. What made you decide not to follow them and decide to pursue music?
Yeah, it's hard to say because one of my main roles at the moment is a music lecturer at a college course. So I have to actually give the careers advice, which is quite funny. But yeah, I guess at that point, I'm a twin. I maybe didn't say at the beginning, but I've got a twin brother that's incredibly academically gifted, and he went to go study law, and a couple of our other friends went to go study medicine and a lot of academia and stuff. And I always just felt like, at the end of the day, if the job that you do means that you've had to like learn a lot of stuff out of books, then you can do that at any stage in your life. But there's only a short period of your life that you can really dedicate to being like broke, to being dedicated to traveling, to practicing for 8, 9, 10 hours a day, to really giving everything you have to that thing. And I was kind of like, if nothing happens for me by, you know, my mid-30s, then I can still go and study to go do like a quote-unquote real job. And I knew as soon as I got those like Alice in Chains CDs and Nirvana CDs, I was like, I don't care how or what the route is, but I need this to be my life. I just never stopped thinking that way, I suppose.
Yeah, that's amazing, man. It's a strange career choice. And as you say, you know, you can just change later in life. But I mean, I did the same thing. And so did my wife, and so did a lot of my friends. You know, you kind of get to a point and you go, I don't really think there's anything else I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to study music, even though I know that I'm sort of setting myself up for a long and difficult road.
Yeah, it's the absolute truth. But I think there's community and there's like unity in that as well. Like I love meeting people that have done that because it's kind of like your badge of honor. And that's not to sound like ignorant as to like people that don't do it aren't in the club, but really giving up all of those comforts for 10 or 15 years of your life to like give back to something that has given you so much. There is a certain amount of like humbleness and like nobility in that that I don't think anyone can deny. And yeah, I always tip my hat to anyone that's committed to that.
So you said you give them careers advice. Are you recommending that people pursue music degrees?
Well, it depends if any of my students are listening to this or not. Yeah, I mean, I think it depends what you want from music. So I think if the way that you kind of view music education in the UK at the very least is that you either take one of a few paths. One is that you want to be a music teacher, and there's quite a specific path you have to go down, and you can't do that without a music degree. So there's that. That's what you have to do. If you want to go be a person that tours and acts as a session musician, there's a base level of soft skills that you need that are like networking, interactive skills, like how do you actually conduct yourself in business? And then there's also the more kind of like hard skills, like how do you actually work as a session musician? Can you pick up 3 or 4 instruments, do one session, understand the theory? How can you do a key change? How can you change keys for an entire song, change the instrument, like all of that kind of stuff? So you do actually have to do a reasonable amount of studying to do that. Like working out by ear can only get you so far. So I think if that's the route people want to go down, there's that. But equally, things have changed so much in the last like even 5 years when we look at things like having a YouTube channel. So like a lot of people now want to run like a review channel where they review tons of gear. They'll have a podcast. They'll also maybe be in a band. They'll maybe give guitar lessons. And so we have all these different sort of revenue streams. And if you want to be one of those entrepreneurial sort of musicians, I don't think you need to study anything really. I think you have to have a vision for what it is you want, have discipline. And I think if you have those two things, you're onto a winner. Like as long as you put the time into learning whatever the thing is, you'll do that. I mean, you can learn how to use a DAW in a summer. You can learn how to edit video on Premiere Pro. You can learn how to use Final Cut. You can do all that stuff in a summer. So I wouldn't advise going to uni for that kind of thing. But it's a case-to-case basis. It depends what people want out of their life and if they want security and which, you know, which world of music they want to work in. If people want to be in a basement and make black metal on a 4-track recorder, then you don't need a degree for
that. Yeah, that's right.
You know? What's your point of view? What do you reckon?
You know what? These days, I'm not entirely sure. I do agree with you that if you want to be doing some of the more advanced elements of making music, then a degree does help because at least it gives you a knowledge base, kind of sets you up to start in that world. Then again, if you look at student loans, I'm still paying off mine.
Same.
And that was largely because I left the country for 7 years and didn't pay anything on it. But it's a big financial commitment. And quite a lot of people have said to me that if I took that amount of money and gave it to a studio to work there for 2 years, I probably would have learned a lot more than I learned in my degree in terms of audio production. So I'm 50-50. I guess it does depend on the person and what exactly you want out of studying music. For some people, it ruins music. Some people, you know, I saw the class that I started in was 35 people and the class that I ended in was 5 people.
Wow.
People learn along the way that they don't actually really want to do this, that learning the intricacies of how music is made and how music is constructed and composed is something that puts them off being entirely creative with the music. Now, maybe makes them overthink it.
Yeah, I understand that as well.
Yeah. You said before something about committing 9 to 10 hours of practice in a day. Is that something that you do or have done?
I did for the first 5 or 6 years that I played guitar. I practiced anything from 4 to 5 up to 10 hours a day sometimes. Yeah. So I did that for years. And then not so much at uni, but definitely through college, it was back down to like the 3, 4, 5 hours a day sort of thing. Yeah. But I was a bit more like, I kind of just see learning a lot of the theory and the kind of technical exercises just as a way of having access to more tools. Like I just wanted to be able to find ways that I could make sounds or recognize sounds. I was actually given a lecture today about the purpose of writing lots and lots of music. It's not so that you have like tons of songs. It's so that you know how to access this bag of tools now if you need it. So whenever you've got this idea about melody that you just can't work out how to get down, well, if you practice writing songs with a MIDI keyboard long enough, you'll be able to just find that sound like real quick. So I was like that with my guitar practice and singing practice and stuff. I was just so desperate to have access to this stuff that would make the music that I wanted to make. That was my kind of approach with it.
Yeah, I mean, and for everyone listening who's kind of bulking at that amount of practice, I will say that many people that I've talked to that have a high level of technical proficiency have put in years of that amount of practice. It's not to say that everyone has to. You don't have to reach that level to make amazing music. And I know plenty of musicians also who make incredible music and write incredible songs that don't have that level of technical proficiency. But I think for a lot of people, that is what it takes to get to that level. And when I look at the musicians that I look up to, even my peers that are much more advanced than I am at my instrument, the reason quite often is because they've put in that hard work where I haven't. So if you're listening to this, maybe stop listening, pick up your instrument.
Yeah, go practice. Yeah, no, I also need to kind of caveat that with not doing that now. I mean, I did that for like the guts of 10 years that I didn't have to do it now. But yeah, that's a really important point to say that you don't have to do that to be an accomplished, incredible musician. Absolutely not. But for me, it's like, I've just got this kind of theme with my life that nothing has ever come easy, and being good at music is one of those. Like I'm not naturally actually very good at music, and that's why I've had to put that much time in. And I'm not naturally very good at like endurance running, but I've given so much of my time to that for like 5, 6, 7 years. Same with production. It's like all these things that I've not naturally been good at, I've been lucky enough to be, you know, I've always been a really, really hard worker. And I just try to put that into a few things and do that really well instead of like 100 things that I do at 10% because I can't do that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Now, mathcore.
Yes.
We've talked about Slipknot and you've mentioned a few bands, you know, the influences that were influencing your band. When did it kind of start to transform into something more extreme, experimental and complex? You know, what sort of bands and what sort of influences pushed you in that direction?
The first group that I listened to that were kind of pushing boundaries in my eyes were probably Isis, to be honest, if anyone doesn't know their like one of the first quote unquote bigger sort of post-metal bands that were using time signatures in a bit of a weird way and using really hypnotic sort of drum patterns and kick patterns and stuff, and really building on this idea of using a kick and a bass guitar to just expand an idea for like 11 or 12 minutes and then eventually move the motif on a little bit. So yeah, I guess those guys were one of the first that I listened to that I liked that were doing that. And then I always find them a bit slow, though, like their tempo. You know, a lot of doom people are big on them because the tempo is quite slow and a little bit kind of on the chilled side. So, yeah, I found them. And then I was kind of getting a bit more into, I guess at that point, it was also like Dillinger maybe came on the scene for me then. And that would have been 2007, 2008, maybe around that sort of time. And also like Strapping Young Lad as well. That was also one of the first groups that was kind of like really quite extreme to me at that point, obviously just being primarily Slipknot and Trivium. And then, yeah, I found these sort of like more extreme sort of groups. And yeah, I think Dillinger were probably the one that kind of broke the back of that whole thing for me, because I mean, even now I'm still kind of finding things about that band, and I've listened to them for like 10 years, 11 years, however long, and I still listen to it and go, what, like, what are they doing? And even the first time I ever heard it, I was just so confused. It was like the Slipknot thing. I was just kind of like, there's something in here that I love dearly, but I just have no idea what it is. So I'd say that kind of amalgamation of groups.
Yeah, awesome. And so can you talk about a little bit about how you formed Frontera?
Yeah, Frontera is a super interesting sort of story in general. It's a bit wild. So basically, it's the brainchild of Ped Valiani, and he is just one of the most talented, incredible musicians, producer type guys I've ever met. And so, yeah, how this all began was he had a band called Sectioned before Frontera, and that's very grindy, power violence-y, in the nails sort of category, Fool of Hell, that sort of thing. And they supported my old band on our last show before we broke up. And they emptied the whole venue, the whole place, however many hundred people, they emptied it because it was just so pulverizing and violent. And at that point, all they did was have strobes from start to finish for their like 20-minute set. And it was just like, you know, that was 2009 or 10, I think, at that point as well. So, I mean, mathcore wasn't that cool at that point yet. That was still pretty edgy. And so, yeah, they emptied the whole place. And I was like, yeah, I love it. I want to play in that band because this is my band's last show. So that's the first time I met Ped. And at that point, they're having some member rearrangements of Sectioned. So it actually panned out. Yeah, he phoned me, I think, a couple months after that. And he was like, because at that, also at that point, there weren't many folk in our sort of local area in Glasgow playing seven string guitars. And so the other band I was in at that point was. And yeah, he was just like, yeah, obviously you've got chops. Let's kind of get you in for like a Sectioned trial and we'll kind of get you in for that. And at that time, Frontera was just an online project that he had mentioned. He just said at that time, yeah, I'm also doing this thing called Frontera with a guy called Chad in America. And it's just going to be like an album. I don't think it's going to really turn into much, but just FYI. Like a month later, Orange Mathematics came out and just broke the internet. It just absolutely blew up. And so he was kind of getting this idea in his head then maybe to try put a live band together. And then obviously Sectioned had kind of gone on the back burner just for a little while all the bubbling was kind of going on under the surface for Frontera. And so then he was like, yeah, why don't we just kind of shift all the personnel from Sectioned over to Frontera? And we did. We literally lifted every member that was in the band at the time, put it into Frontera. And Chad was obviously in America. We learned Orange Mathematics and we booked our first show, which was like a massive festival in England, Tech Fest, and we were on just before Between the Buried and Me on the main stage.
Wow.
And that was our first show. We had never met until like the day before, all of us. We never had a full band practice. Obviously, Chad flew in from the States. We had one full band practice and then drove for 9 hours down to Nottingham for this festival. And obviously the full, like the Scottish contingency of the group had tried to rehearse. But at that point, Callum was living in Portugal as well. So we only had like one actual full band rehearsal for 3 hours before we did our first show. And anyone that's listened to Frontera will know it's really complex, kind of polyrhythmic, obscure, very fast tempoed kind of music. So it's not like a jam band kind of bluesy thing. It's very meticulous and incredibly articulate in the way that you kind of play all the parts together. So it's on YouTube. If you have a look, if anyone wants to see it, it's there, UK Tech Fest 2016. And it's by, like, I consider it to be not a very good performance. It, you know, we hadn't gelled, we hadn't spent time doing the thing that bands have to spend time doing, which is kind of creating that synergy and the telekinesis that develops after years of playing together. And so it was quite eye-opening, that, because it really revealed that there's a massive fan base for this band and we had never played a show, but also that it could be done. And that was the kind of thing that kind of stuck in the back of my mind. I was like, man, this is like a ticket to some pretty amazing experiences if we can manage it correctly. After that, I was running a management business at that time. So for about 4 or 5 years, I was booking tours and managing bands, and I had like And So I Watch You From Afar and Toy Mountains and like a bunch of kind of local Scottish and Irish bands. So I was like fairly clued up on managing bands and touring and all that stuff. So yeah, me and Ped basically took it on and did all the booking and management and yeah, got it off the ground. And then it's just been grown and grown ever since. It's genuinely been a bit of an internet sort of phenomenon. And yeah, incredibly grateful I've gotten to tour so much of the world because of that band. It's just been just incredible.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know about Frontera until you released, what's your current record that's not...
Oh, Unloved. Yeah, the latest one.
Unloved. Yeah, when that came out, I got into the loop. So I didn't see it all kind of blow up on the internet beforehand. So that's amazing to hear.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah, it was so like cool. the biggest selling thing on Bandcamp the day that it came out. So like of all the music on Bandcamp, that was the biggest selling thing. And yeah, that's like insane to me. I mean, I was like a friend of Ped's at that time. That was all Ped and Chad. Like he had written, produced, and basically split the writing with Chad, and then Brad Boatwright in the States had mastered it. But all Ped, the whole thing, absolutely unbelievable.
Crazy. So Frontera has been a bit of a journey, obviously, but since COVID, you guys haven't been able to play or tour. Mm-hmm. And like many musicians during that time, you've had time to put your energy into other projects, and you're about to release that project and you've called it Lift.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's go into that, man. How did it come about? What's the idea behind the project?
So Lift is kind of the product of me having quite a lot of like mental health difficulties over the last sort of year. For people that don't know, I'm a really big mental health advocate, and I do a lot of work generally across the board for awareness and working on a number of different projects, some of them with our like local health board for a thing called Breathing Space. It's a part of the health service where people can phone anonymously if they feel, you know, mentally unwell or that they're at risk or anything like that. Totally anonymous service. And so I've done a bit of work with them. And yeah, it's just been a big part of my life. Like I said, I've kind of had to struggle for a lot of the things that I have, and that includes my health. So yeah, I was having quite a bad spell last year. Music for me has always been like a shelter or a bit of a solace throughout the best and the worst parts of my life. But I've always used music to express how I feel in that moment. And so playing in Section or Frontera has always been a very like visceral and a live experience. I get to just like shed a layer pretty much whenever I do that. And that allows me to express anger and rage and hatred and those things. But I can't do that at the moment because it's, you know, we can't tour, can't travel, can't do anything. So I was like, okay, I need to like channel all of these feelings and manage this a little bit. So why don't I make music that represents how I want to feel instead of how I do feel? Because I was really like depressed and low. And so then I was like, yeah, why don't I try make a record that's like incredibly uplifting and powerful and ethereal, and let's just see what happens. I had no intentions of making a full release. I had no intentions of even, you know, doing anything beyond producing a piece of music that would make me feel better, to be honest. And so that kind of grew arms and legs the more that I kind of worked on it. And I think I began working on it in July last year. And I'm so lucky, like my setup at the moment is basically that I've got like 3 months of the year off, and that's usually for touring. But now I had all this time off, so I kind of had like a month and a half, 2 months over summer to work on this when I would normally be touring. So yeah, I kind of spent July until about a month ago finishing all the kind of writing for this. And it's kind of in the vein of, I guess, elements of like the experimental side of Bon Iver, the electronic experimental stuff that he does. Also then like FKA Twigs or Bjork or Arca, these kind of like grand experimental electronic sort of artists. And I ended up basically trying to write parts that I wasn't capable of programming. And then I was kind of like damn, who can I get to do this? And I've got a really eclectic taste in music. So I actually love a lot of like electronic music, and I have done since my brother used to give me rave and EDM when I was a kid. So yeah, I've actually been friends with Adam Betts for a little while. So when I used to manage And So I Watch You From Afar, he did some work on one of their records, and he used to play in Three Trap Tigers. And so I'd actually seen him play with like Deftones and Dillinger and a bunch of incredible, incredible bands. And so, yeah, I just got chatting to him and sent him this track that I wanted to have a really intricate, interesting drum beat on, and he loved it. And so he took on one of those tracks called Zauer, and that's going to be, that'll be the first single. I think we're going to try to have that out by the 16th of April. And then I had another two people that I wanted involved in the record in some fashion, but I just didn't really know how. So a really dear friend of mine, Finlay Marinell, is one of the guys I went to uni with, and he's just developed this incredible style of music playing, kind of like Mike Dawes, like percussive sort of acoustic guitar work, but he's got just this beautiful, angelic, unique sort of voice, really like Joanna Newsom, like super nuanced and really, really interesting sort of accent. I wanted him to kind of contribute in some way, so he actually sent me like a handful of songs, and then I picked one of those, so me and him have collaborated on one, and then there was a third track there that I was like, I want just a really mad experimental, no holds barred sort of tune. And so I'd like picked apart another one of his songs, integrated it with a bunch of like weird breakbeat sort of jungle sort of ideas that I had. And I just couldn't get the beat right. And I really love Machine Drum and some of the records that he's put over the last years. And it's a guy called Ian Masiak that does the drums on that. And he's just incredible. Like he's actually designed a lot of the sound design for the Headspace app for like meditating, but he's also Machine Drum. Yeah. And basically in my mind, one of the world's best like breakbeat and jungle drummers who can actually play it and play it properly. So I couldn't believe it. Yeah, I was basically trying to program this beat, couldn't do it, got really fed up, and I emailed him out of the blue, and I was like, dude, I know that you're like this fucking superstar in the breakbeat world, but have a listen to this track. Do you want to play on it? It would be so good if you could. And he got back to me within an hour, and he was like, yeah man, sign me up, just send me the stems and I'll do it. I just my mind was like absolutely blown. I couldn't believe that he wanted to be a part of it. And that was kind of like the last collaborative sort of part of this. So the way I'm kind of trying to explain it is that it's a bit more like a book of poems than it is a full book with consistent chapters. It feels like it's got like a thread that runs through it, but it's just kind of glimpses into general ideas, I think is maybe the way to kind of think about that.
Yeah.
Not general ideas, that makes it seem a bit random. It's not that, but it's not a cohesive album. It's kind of, it's seven tracks somewhere in that EP mini album territory. And I kind of want to see how this sits before I go and do a full release, but I'm incredibly proud of it. I think it's created something that I've been trying to kind of find a way to do for years and years. And now I've had the time, the resources, and the kind of mental headspace to actually do it. Yeah, I'm so excited to get it out there and see what people think about it.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. When you sit down to compose, like when you first were like, okay, I'm actually going to do this, something I've been planning on, you know, doing, what's your process look like?
So for me, it's a mixture of using actual composition skills and understanding what I kind of want the final thing to be. I was in the same lecture I mentioned earlier, I was kind of talking about this with students today. I think it's important to kind of have a bit of a vision for what it is that you want. And so I've always, like I said earlier, I've been obsessed with this idea of creating a world that your art lives in. And that means that there can't be boundaries, because it is exactly that. It's an endless world of things. And so I wanted Lift just to be that. So I've got a really like beautiful sort of aesthetic that is tied in with this whole thing, and I get to kind of lock it off in there. So for me, I wanted like a really ethereal, misleading sort of undertone to the beginning of the record. And the first thing I wrote was basically that. I just kind of played around with some soft synth pads, and I knew that I wanted something that was kind of going to be in that territory of like almost like Oathbreaker or Lingua Ignota, something that is just like a little bit kind of dark and terrifying at the same time, just to kind of like feed into that idea that, you know, there's nowhere to hide. It's like, it feels like these synth pads are giving you this warm, lush sort of texture, and then something comes in to kind of wreck that. And that's the first track kind of does that. I should have said, actually, the record's called There's Beauty in Everything. And so it's like this idea of finding like dark and shade and light and color and everything that happens. I think sonically, the record kind of does that. It goes from these places that are kind of like light and dark and shade. And so, yeah, ultimately, I kind of want to think about textures. I want to think about how I want the listener to feel, and if that kind of gets across how I want to express myself. So, yeah, effectively building up a mood, building up a vibe. And then I'll usually have a hook of some description that I have in my mind. And the first track on the record is called L1. that was like a chopped up vocal sample that I'd kind of made. But when I exported that into an audio file to then manipulate further, it got totally jacked up, but it turned into something way more interesting when I did that. So the mistake of that export actually turned it into something that is now the vocal sample that's in that song. Cool. So there's a little bit of like kind of like production mishaps, but equally the kind of final mixing on that's kind of made it sound really like ethereal and broad. So yeah, I mean, it's a big blend of like traditional compositional methods and more modern production methods as well. I guess that's maybe a more concise answer.
Yeah, sure. No, that's good. I did actually get to listen to it just before we came on and super impressed.
Thanks.
What are some of the instruments? You know, there's some really interesting sounds on there. What are some of the main instruments that you've used, whether they're software plugins or actual hardware instruments?
Yeah, so I don't really like kind of setting the bar low. So I was kind of like, I don't want to release a record that's good for a guy that's a guitar player or good for the guy in Frontier. I wanted it to be objectively a good record for someone that likes good quality music of any kind. I think if people like EDM, they like this. If people like grind, they like this. I think generally speaking, people will find something to attach to. And I wanted that to be the case. So instrument choices was entirely based around what I wanted the songs to feel like. So there's some songs that are literally just all synth pads and an 808. There's some songs that have electric guitars, some that are just bass and like a nice piano line. I did some field recordings for like just ambient background noise with just the piano for one track. And I do a lot of singing in this record as well. So for me, it was just like whatever is going to get the overall idea across. And yeah, I basically have like a really nice MIDI keyboard that I use, some good mics, and then the rest is basically plugins or the contributions from Adam Betts or Ian Masiak. They have their own like amazing drum setups that they use, which I really recommend people go and have a look at. They've both got gear reviews or rig rundowns, I should say, on YouTube. Just insane setups, just so impressive.
Yeah. Okay, well, what if there was one plugin that you would say contributed most to this record, what would it be?
I guess...
instrumental or otherwise?
It would have to be like a reverb of some sort, I suppose. There's just so much texture in this album. There's not a single track that's not soaked in reverb. So yeah, maybe Valhalla.
Yeah.
I also really have to say the Neural DSP guitar stuff is unbelievable. I've got that in a few places on the record as well. Yep. Like anything Pliny related, like ethereal guitar sounds, they're just so lush. I think a mixture of anything with a time-based effect on it, essentially.
Yeah, awesome. I can also recommend the Valhalla reverbs. I use them constantly on everything.
Yeah, they're incredible.
They are. Okay, so, I mean, I think we've maybe already alluded to the process, but let's just dive in there anyway. Are you following the typical, you know, band process of having an idea, demoing it, you know, making a skeleton of a song as a demo, and then moving it to a side and starting from scratch with that idea, re-recording it in a proper version for the final track? Mm-hmm. Or is it something that you've started with and slowly evolves, and the tracks that you've started with are the tracks that we're going to hear on this EP?
So I made a folder of a bunch of offshoots and ideas, and I think for me, like, a lot of ideas revolve around a hook of some sort. So if that's like a chord progression or like a melody or like a vocal line or something like that, I'll always try and kind of like use that as a beginning of something, and then I'll kind of establish like the basic idea, demo it, and then I'll do like a final version. Yeah, I've got like three or four drafts of every song that's on the record, but there's another two or three songs that were never used. I should also say I've got a really good friend of mine, Ian McLeod. He's the front of house engineer for Frontier. He's a sound wizard. I just don't know how he does the stuff he does, but he's done some additional mixing and some extra bits of production on the record. But he's kind of made it go from like to being quite good in my eyes to being like the best it can be. So he's had quite a big hand in this as well. But yeah, effectively I try and demo the idea until I've got it as like the final form, and then it's about the kind of nuances and the specific sounds and the where it sits in the like stereo image and all the kind of nerdy stuff after that.
Nice. What's your goal with Lift? I mean, you did allude to it before. I guess the title alludes to it as well, but what do you hope that you will accomplish by releasing this?
In some way, like, it sounds really pretentious, but I think in some ways I've kind of achieved what I wanted to. I've made a record that I'm incredibly proud of, and if not a single soul listens to it, then I'm honestly not going to be heartbroken about that, because it's what I want it to be. In a best case scenario, people attach themselves to it. I think I just want people to feel something when they hear it. I don't need them to like it. I don't need them to kind of tell all their friends about it. But I've made it with a lot of emotional sort of attachment and expression. And I think if people can hear it and just feel a little something in their day that kind of makes them just look inward for a second or two, that's all I'm really looking for. Beyond that, you know, whatever happens, happens. It'd be cool if it kind of got into the hands of a few people that could spread the word a bit more than others. But yeah, it's not my goal. I just want people to find something about it that they can feel a thing to. It's quite a vague answer.
No, that's wonderful. I connect with that. Some of my more recent projects have had the same idea. Mm-hmm. You know, just putting yourself into some music and hoping that if people hear it, even if they don't enjoy it, if it makes them feel something, then it's kind of accomplished its goal.
That's it.
And yeah, more than anything, it's for yourself and, you know, for your own therapy, I suppose, and for your own satisfaction as a musician. I'm sure, I mean, I've listened to it and I like it. Mm. Obviously, we actually have very similar music tastes and journeys. Mm. So it's not really surprising that I like it, but I think if you put all of yourself into something and it's so carefully considered and there's so much love that went into it, there's going to be a whole lot of people that are going to connect with it.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, that really means a lot. Really appreciate that. I need to say as well, I'm so grateful to people that have been invested in it so far. I only launched the social media for it on Saturday, just past there. And there's like hundreds of people that are involved in it already. And it doesn't go unnoticed, you know, like all the Frontier fans, the Section fan, people that have followed things I've done since I was like 18. It's like, it totally does not go, you know, it's not missed on me. Like I really, it does mean the world that anyone cares at all about the sounds that I am trying to make to kind of exercise some demons that I've got. And it's honestly heartwarming how much people care. So yeah, I need to absolutely extend that.
Awesome. And Dan, thank you for doing it. You know, I think that's something that we also need to put out there is thank you to all the fans who are listening to all this music, but also thank you to you and musicians and everyone who's played on that record for putting themselves into their art and sharing it with the world.
Thanks kindly, man. That's so nice.
Okay, so I've got a little quiz that we end up the podcast with, just a bit of fun, and we're just going to smash through them. The best way to approach this is just the first thing that comes to mind. Don't overthink it. So who's your favorite artist?
Oh, Bon Iver.
Nice. Top three albums overall, doesn't have to be by one artist.
Incubus, Morning View, FK1 LP, and Bon Iver for Emma Forever Ago.
Nice. That's
very
amazing.
Broad.
Yeah. The top three sounding records, best like sonically.
Jonesy from Sigur Rós's new record, Shiver, is the best thing you will hear in the last year, 100%. After that, I think Machine Drum, A View of You, absolutely phenomenal production. And then maybe something by Deftones like White Pony. There's just something about that that's just, man, it captures a moment in time. It's just unreal.
I agree. The best live show that you've ever seen?
Oh, no. So many different ones for different reasons. some of the best that I've seen. I have to say Bon Iver is one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life. Like it literally changed my life. I guess Dillinger has to be up there. It's again, insane. And The Chariot, I was living in Melbourne when I saw The Chariot and it just, man, again, I couldn't believe people can do that stuff on stage.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. The best live show that you've played?
Oh, I think for different reasons, I'm going to have to be a cop out and give you two here. So one would be Arctangent last year or 2019. We headlined the tent at Arctangent and it was the most stressful day. And it probably ties into one of the questions you might ask about the worst show as well. So that was incredible. And then the first time we played in Paris, we didn't expect anyone to turn up. The whole venue sold out. They were literally tearing the roof down in our set. It was one of the most eye-opening things I've ever seen. Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Oh, that's amazing. I am forever jealous of Arctangent. We did manage to go in 2015, I think we went, and it was absolutely incredible. And then we left England before the next one. Mm. But every year that it's happened ever since, I'm very, very jealous.
It's an amazing festival. I've been at it every year since 2014, so we would have been in the same field at some point, which is quite bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. That was the year I went was the year that Dillinger Escape Plan played.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah. Do you remember there was a guy climbing up the middle sort of tower that was holding the whole tent together? That was one of my best friends, man. He is the fill-in guitar player for Frontiera when I can't do it. our boy Simon.
legendary show, legendary night, legendary festival. Big ups to ArcTangent. Okay, so yeah, I do have a recurring segment where I ask my guests and I make a compilation of it later in the year when I have enough. Worst gig stories. Is there a story that stands out to you as the worst time ever?
I've got two that come to mind, but honestly, I've got like an endless well of these stories, but two that definitely stick out. So the first one is accidental entirely. So first time Frontiera played in Budapest in Hungary, I think it was, it must have been. I've got a tendency to like split my trousers or my shorts because I've got the big old wide stance and the low and slow sort of chug thing. And I had split my shorts like two songs into the set, but I also had super baggy boxers on, and I did the foot on the wedge sort of power stance. And if anyone got a picture of what was beneath my guitar, man, I'd be on a list and exported from the country immediately. Yeah. Like I was hanging brain for at least a whole song. and then I was like crowd surfing after it. And just like, man, someone has absolutely skin to skin contacted me and I didn't know about it until after. Just horrendous.
That's amazing.
So that was no good. And then, yeah, the second one is actually that ArcTangent set from 2019. The set itself wasn't bad, but you'll need to give me a minute here to tell the story because it was just so ridiculous. So basically, driving from Glasgow to outside of Bristol is like a 10-hour drive without much traffic. So organized the van hire and all the usual stuff that comes with that. And Chad had flown his wife over, who was 6 months pregnant at the time. So I hadn't factored in P stops every kind of half hour or whatever. But anyway, so we get to the van hire place to pick up the van in the morning, and someone has set the whole warehouse on fire. They've tried to burn the whole van hire company down, and this is the biggest show of our year. It's like the round off to the summer touring and headlining a festival stage, man, thousands of people. It was just one of those like you cannot miss it sort of things. And I'd given like a buffer of 2 hours just for like general things to go wrong. And we had spent an hour and 45 minutes waiting at the place for the guys to just find a van from somewhere. So they did. We were lucky we even got a van. And then we picked up all the guys and Chad and his wife. And, you know, not her fault at all, but she had to stop and pee all the time over the 10-hour drive. And so we were already like 2 hours away, and our load-in time, I think, was at that point. And it was a festival. You get a line check of an hour, half an hour sort of thing, and then you go. So by this point, I knew that we were never going to make that. We basically were going to turn up to our stage time to then have our light check, line check, go sort of thing. And I had to drive at 90 miles an hour on the motorway and subsequently got 3 points on my license and a fucking huge fine. And we got into the festival grounds for stage time, which gave us a 15-minute window to line check, sound check, and begin our set. And we were only 3 minutes over the set, over the start time for the set, but it was the most stressful thing. Before we'd even put a thing on the stage, there were 500 people there waiting to see us. Like, oh my God. It was one of those sort of, we only play the UK once every 2 years, so there's like a lot of people. And then by the time we'd finished the line check and the light check, I think it must have been like 1500, 2000 or something, but it was just like, whoa, man. When that first song started, I was just like, I channeled the Ben Weinman in me, and I was like, not to be seen again for 45 minutes. Oh, it was so hectic.
That's amazing. Oh, see, it's those stories, dude. It's those stories. Yeah. Those are the ones I think a lot of touring musicians can connect with, the stressful times.
Yeah, big time.
Most bad gig stories revolve around stressful times in a van.
Yeah, totally. But it, like I said, it led to a phenomenal gig, and like the guys at Audio Tree and stuff were there and filmed it. And we had so many friends, and it really felt like a community. We actually had a few friends that we had been touring with earlier in the summer playing there as well. And yeah, man, it was just so much fun. Once the playing was done, it was good.
All right. Well, I'm going to go and check out the first show. It was TechFest, wasn't it?
TechFest, yeah, that's
I'm going to check that out on YouTube, and I'm also...
It's not that good.
Yeah, but I want to see.
I wouldn't recommend it. I don't think it's that good.
I'm just interested to see because, you know, of the circumstances. And I'm also going to go and check out the Audio Tree recording of ArcTangent that year.
Yeah, it's good. There's what songs did the guys from Audio Tree do that did Light Show Paralysis, and Tunnel Jumper, I think, were the two. It was Austin Isaac that did it. Really beautiful camera lens that he had on. So yeah, if anyone wants to see those, they're pretty good.
Love Audio Tree. They're amazing. Okay, Dan, well, dude, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I really, really appreciate it. I've been so lucky to go to New Zealand before. I spent like 3 weeks traveling around there when I lived in Australia, and I am destined to retire back over there. My wife put off like 2 trips when she met me just to spend extra time with me instead of go to New Zealand, and she never got to go. So I owe her a trip big time.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Well, as soon as this is all cleared up, come down and I'll show you around.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you for listening to the Musician's Map podcast. You can like, follow, subscribe, or whatever you want to do on whatever platform you're listening to. Watch out for the next episode. I'm not sure when it's coming, but I'm not calling it quits just yet. If you're listening to this and you want to be a guest on the Musician's Map podcast, reach out to me at kane@precisionpodcasting.com or through the Precision Podcasting website. Thanks for listening.